Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Paul Polman. Paul is a business leader, campaigner, and co-author of Net Positive, How Courageous Companies Thrive by Giving More Than They Take, a Financial Times Business Book of the Year. Paul works to accelerate action by business to tackle climate change and inequality. As CEO of Unilever for a decade, he demonstrated that business can profit through purpose, delivering shareholder returns of 290% while the company consistently ranked number one in the world for sustainability. Today, he works across a range of organizations to deliver the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which he helped to develop. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Paul, for the opportunity, and I should thank you for what you're doing to make this just, prosperous, and sustainable world for all, and with the Conduit having a mechanism to accelerate the bigger changes that we need. So grateful for what you are doing.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, while we're on that topic, I think that the sort of pioneering business leader that you have represented is exactly the reason why we're trying to bring together this community of people to accelerate change. So let's talk about your book, because it's making all sorts of waves, has had an incredible critical response, and also is being well read by an enormous range of influential people. What is Net Positive, and what made you write the book?
So if I start with the second part, I never really wanted to write a book because I have this phobia in my mind that any CEO writes a book is either to change the course of history or stroke his own ego, and usually hims instead of hers. The hers wouldn't do this. So I've always been hesitant to write a book, but then I got cornered by Adi Ignatius from the Harvard Business Press, and he said, what you've done and what you're trying to do with Unilever, you might not have achieved all the things that you set out to do, but it's very important that businesses understand that, the challenges, the learnings, and you can reach so many more people if you put it on paper. And thought about it, COVID came, and it was an ideal opportunity to do this. And the real reason for the book is not the book itself, although it's doing well. It was the second most successful book for Harvard Business Press last year. So it gets a good, it was a good timing in that sense. But what we're really trying to achieve with that book is to create a movement where we want to change mindsets. If you really look at even what we did at Unilever, despite all these efforts, it was still in the less bad category, a little bit less carbon emissions, a little bit less deforestation, a little bit less plastics in the oceans. But the issue, Paul, is we've overshot these planetary boundaries to such an extent that less bad is still bad. It's just not good enough. And we have to get companies to start thinking regenerative, restorative, reparative. And that's what we call net positive. Last year, World Overshoot Day was July 28th, which is the day that we use up all resources that the world can replenish. In fact, I would argue that after that day, every day after, we're actually stealing from future generations. So just to be less bad is not good enough anymore. Most people understand that when you explain it to them, but they struggle not anymore with the why that is needed, but the how to do it. So this is a very practical book where we take the best examples that we can find, our own experience, and put it in a very practical way. And what we call a net positive company is a company that first and foremost takes responsibility of its total footprint in the world. Many companies think that they can still outsource their value chain and also outsource their responsibilities. That just doesn't work anymore. A company that sets targets in line with science and not in line with what they can get away with. I call it playing to win versus not to lose. A company that operates for its multiple stakeholders and not myopically focused on the shareholder or the quarters, and but tries to be there for the longer term, put sustainability at the core of their strategies. And last but not least, a company that is actively involved in the broader systems changes that are needed. CEOs are looking at the interest of their companies and protecting those, whatever it takes, via lobbying or industry associations or other things. What we're talking here about is positive engagement to make the system work, optimizing within the current system that frankly isn't designed to deliver anymore, only catch you this far. So those are the hallmarks of net positive companies. We ask ourselves a very simple question, which is how can you profit from solving the world's problems, not creating the world's problems? And is the world better off because your company is in it, yes or no? And these are sort of the things that we're trying to drive. And as I said, the timing is right. The reception has been good. And now it's the hard work of implementing. It's Stephen Covey said it well in his book, Seven Habits. If you remember that book, I read it. Actually, I liked it. But it said, you cannot talk yourself out of things you've behaved yourself into. So we've behaved ourselves into a small problem, lifted a lot of people out of poverty. But now the music stops playing. We're creating these issues now. We're actually pushing people back into poverty. We're way off on the climate change scale, still projecting a 14% increase this decade, whilst we need a 50% decline. So it's now really time for action. And that's very much the spirit of this book.
So your book has a set of positive case studies or examples. And you know firsthand from being a CEO that running a company is difficult and complicated, and no single company is heroic and doesn't always do only good things. Some of them do things that are complicated as well. But give us some examples of companies that you think are either actually net positive or behaving in net positive ways, so that it gives listeners some actual tangible sense of what that looks like.
Yeah, before I do that, let me add one thing to it. And net positive is a journey, I would say, and not to disappoint your listeners, but I don't think any company is net positive. And it is a very difficult balance, but I think many are striving to become net positive. And what we're trying to say in this book is, if more would be striving, the world would be so much better. But it's also without any doubt that companies alone cannot do it. Hence this last characteristic of working with civil society and governments to drive the broader changes that are needed. But first and foremost, I would say, is it is probably an enormous opportunity now. We are arriving at the point, regretfully, where the cost of not acting is actually becoming significantly higher than the cost of acting. Climate change is the most burning issue, but Deloitte estimated recently that if we don't do anything and stay on the business as usual trajectory between now and 2070, we would incur an additional cost of $178 trillion. And some of the bills are already being sent home today. If we would actually work together by all means possible to stay close to the 1.5 degrees warming, we could actually turn that into an economic benefit of $43 trillion. And in some areas, we're already seeing tipping points. Solar and wind has been often cited, but we're very close to electric vehicles. I think we will be getting there with regenerative agriculture. So you're asking about what are examples of net positiveness in companies. And there are many examples I can mention on the whole spectrum of ESG. But for example, the companies like Danone or Pepsi or Nestle or my former Unilever, making commitments to be 50% regeneratively sourced in agriculure by 2030, 50%, and some of the companies have an individual commitment that is higher. But regenerative agriculture, no tilling, carbon capture, working on soil health, protecting biodiversity goes very much in the direction of net positive. A company like Microsoft making commitments to take carbon out of the air, going all the way back to 1976 when the company started, is an example of being net positive, taking out more than you put in. Water commitments, many companies like the Cokes of this world, which have their own challenges, but making commitments in most of their factories or parts of operation to be water positive would be a net positive commitment. A company let's say MasterCard, trying to reach 500 million people and wanting to be financially inclusive. Unilever trying to get livable wages across its value chain. These are examples of net positive behavior. And then actively participating with others to drive the broader changes. Unilever discovered fairly quickly that you alone can't solve the deforestation in Indonesia or the climate change issues or the human rights issues. So how do you create these alliances that then also help you get the right frameworks in place, the right incentives, and accelerate the moves that you're doing? So these are all net positive examples that I think increasingly we're starting to see. And interestingly, we can now show that there's a highly likelihood of being profitable and being more successful financially as well. If you're a more purpose-driven company, if you run these longer-term multi-stakeholder business models, if you're actually a leader in some of these areas, It's very interesting. A recent study from EY a week or two ago pointed out that they looked at all the companies that were moving on climate change. But then they looked at the pace setters, you know, that small group within the movers that were actually setting the pace. And what they found were that that group was 2.5 times more likely to be more profitable than the rest. So all indicators, and all to say that increasingly we can link it also to very solid financial performance. And that's not a surprise, therefore, that we start to see the financial market move and some of the other, you know, parts of society that that might surprise us, but have caught on to the enormous opportunities and are moving increasingly away from risk mitigation to seizing these opportunities.
So all the data about consumer preferences, citizen preferences, and employee preferences, and we'll come to the last one in a moment because you've done some really fascinating work in this regard, tells us that people are increasingly urgently alarmed about climate on the one hand, are voting with their wallets in terms of the brands they choose to endorse, how they invest their pensions, how they vote their shares increasingly in terms of activism. So we have a move towards more conscious consumption and more conscious citizenship. And then we have this sort of whole area of breakthroughs in tech that can get behind that move on behalf of citizens and shareholders and move us forward. So I want to open up a little parenthesis for a moment and just ask you, because you sit in so many fascinating different worlds, where are you most optimistic about tech breakthroughs on the path to net zero or net positive that you think give you hope that we might, with the right will, get within planetary boundaries to net zero?
Yeah. So despite what people want you to believe and take the easy way out, the winners are going to be the ones that choose the harder rights versus the easier wrongs. And frankly, I have not been able to convince myself yet that it isn't possible to stay within the 1.5 degrees. And frankly, we might overshoot, but then can come back. Some of that's takes time. So I'm talking here about the longer term objective. And we shouldn't move away from that, because any 0.1 degree more is on an exponential scale. Millions and millions more people are going to suffer from it, and it's not us. So by us not acting, we frankly become complicit to the crime against humanity, against actually the people that suffer disproportionately from all of our shortcomings. And we've seen enough of that during COVID. So I like to quote one of your fellow countrymen, Desmond Tutu, who, when he was asked if he was optimistic or pessimistic, and a panel I was on with him at the UN said very simply, "I'm a prisoner of hope." And I think that really captured it extremely well once more. And what you see here is that technology is always going faster than we think. And we always underestimate that speed of technology. I remember in 2014 that the International Energy Agency was predicting that we would be at 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour for solar by 2050, that electric cars would be as cheap as combustion engines by 2050. One we've achieved in 2019, the electric car we're going to achieve today or tomorrow. We're basically there. So the most exciting technology actually comes from the technology companies itself, may I say. We can all talk about hydrogen, where we will see tipping points, or sustainable airline fuel that we desperately need, green steel that is coming, cement that is carbon positive, which is already available to us. By the way, if you would build with wood, you already have a carbon positive building, but it's all possible. But what I'm most excited about is, at the end of the day, the way AI is developing and technology is developing, we can apply as a force for good this time, many of these possibilities that otherwise weren't there. The fact that we can see on the square meter now globally where the forests are being cut, and marrying that up with the concessions that are being given, is a tremendous force in having people behave and protect the forest. The fact that we can now see on the square meter where the methane is coming from and what the flaring is, despite what people say, gives us an enormous tool to drive behavior. So when it gets to precision agriculture, when it gets to electric vehicles, when it gets to many of the other processes that we're putting in place in the energy conversion, this technical component is probably the one that is the most exciting one, because it allows us to measure, which we couldn't do before. One of the reasons I think we have that higher increase of awareness, it allows us to, in a very complicated environment with these multiple variables that you talked about, it allows us to do the deeper analysis and provide the precision. Precision agriculture, for example, would be a good thing. So technology is probably the most important thing. Some people say that alone is about 40% of the climate solutions. I wouldn't be surprised. It's hard to break these things down, but I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm optimistic like you because of this cost of action, inaction that we talked about, of indeed the consciousness, and especially of the Gen Z's, millennials, which we can go into, and of technology itself. And there's no reason for us to fight the mindset that it cannot be done. And, Christiana Figueres has been very clear, it is a mindset. Impossible is a state of mind, and that's up to us to decide which side of that state of mind we want to live.
So speaking of states of mind, you have just completed what I think is a really fascinating attitudinal survey measuring employees' attitudes to sustainability, to the climate crisis, and to values, and have set out some really interesting findings about how employees should think about this data set in relation to retaining and acquiring the single biggest predictor of corporate success, which is talent. So tell us a little bit about this report.
So we're continuing to look, Paul, at indicators that we can push to drive behavior change at an accelerated basis, because we're up against time, not against the direction. And I've always felt that obviously bringing technology awareness and cost curves to the business community is a quite appealing thing. Changing the course of education and creating new leaders is a quite appealing change agent for me. But then we don't have that luxury of time. So we need to go inside of companies as well. I've always believed that in every company, there is a greater Thorburn in the waiting, or it would have been, it was unheard of a few years ago that the Amazon people walk out to tell Jeff Bezos that we have climate change, or that you don't want to work for a company that gives mattresses to the border patrol where children are separated from women, or that is in face recognition and you don't feel the government should have these intrusive methods available to them. So employees are speaking up in increasing amounts. When Goldman Sachs people and McKinsey people start writing letters to their management that they need to be careful which clients they take on and be consistent in what they say and what they do, then you know the world is starting to move. So one of the forces of change, therefore, is employees. Interestingly, engagement scores are fairly low. 15-20% of people that go to work are engaged. That have always surprised me, and I find that actually one of the saddest statistics in life. And increasingly, it is difficult to be able to hire the good people. 65% of the companies in London complain that they can't fill the vacancies that they need to fill, despite the economic situation that is out there. So we think a key catalyzer of change is, in fact, your own workforce, not only the millennials or Gen Zs, but also the people that are there, the baby boomers. But we are at a point in time that half of your work population now, for most companies, it was already in Unilever when I left 3 years ago, but half the company's employees would be millennials or Gen Zs. So their anxiety level goes up. Two-thirds of them are obviously worried about their pay and about their working conditions, and that's quite normal. I call them hygiene factors. It's like if you buy food, you want to be sure that it tastes well before you start talking about if it's made sustainably or not, or if you can afford it. So these are hygiene factors. But then if you peel the onion, you see that they're not just looking for engagement, they're looking for fulfillment. Two-thirds of them are incredibly anxious with what is happening in the world. That number has gone up significantly over the last 2 to 3 years. And that two-thirds is the total population, not just millennials and Gen Zs. So more importantly, that same amount of people expect their companies to be taking responsibility of their total impact, in line with what we found in our Net Positive book. But they also expect companies to be actively part of that. Now, here are the stunning statistics. Half of them believe that the CEO is not serious, that that they're not actively engaged, that they don't put word into action. And one third, as a result, has consciously quit, a new term, consciously quitting. And another 50% is considering doing so if the values continue to be misaligned. So that's a ticking time bomb for any company, to be honest, if you're sitting on that. So constructively, we ask those people, so what does that mean for you? What do you want your companies to do? What are the things that we should be passing on to the CEOs? And we found very clearly three areas, if I may distill them down. The first one is ambition. Employees expect companies to set more ambitions than what they currently do in general to solve these issues. The second part is communication. Whilst they say half of the CEOs might not be serious, we've turned that around and say perhaps they haven't communicated so well. But what we find is in any company, the communication, we looked at that in detail, about 60% of the communication is about work conditions and flexible work. And, you know, free meals and beanbags and ping pong tables. But very few, and mental health is coming in, diversity is coming in, but very limited communication is going out on environmental responsibilities or social responsibilities. It's about one third compared to two thirds. So we say communicate better and be sure that people understand what your plans are, first and foremost, in the company. In Unilever, I spent the first year of my tenure explaining to our employees what we were going to do before we were going outside. So set your ambitions, communicate better, and the third element is to empower. The millennials and the Gen Zs want to be part of the solution. They don't want to walk away. They have incredibly creative ideas, and they want to be involved and help these companies on this difficult but needed trajectory.
So you've led a company that's been in the spotlight. Your leadership has been under the spotlight. You have withstood that, and you know history will treat you enormously kindly in terms of both the business success but also your commitment to sustainability. Increasingly, CEOs find themselves wedged between the short-term imperatives, responding to the markets, responding to shareholders, responding to pension funds, responding to increasingly aggressive activist shareholders who don't necessarily take a long-term view in the way that you have. And on the other hand, they have their employees, as you've just articulated, and citizens and consumers wanting them to play the long game. And so they find themselves wedged between two time horizons and two value sets. Tell us how you would advise people think through these dilemmas or these tensions when you're a leader.
I think the times are better now, Paul, than they were when I started that 13, 14 years ago, when no data was available, when the concepts were still a little bit novel, when shareholder primacy perhaps ruled even more than it does today. We came off the height of the financial crisis, so people sometimes forget how these things, we go through these waves in history. But that was not an easy time. And when I came out with our Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, was a lot of skepticism. So fast forward now to 15 years later, more or less, we might see increasingly a convergence of the shareholders' interest with the stakeholders that you talk about. We now know that more diverse companies are better performing companies, that companies that more aggressively attack climate change have a higher chance of being more profitable. And what has changed is that 50 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, 85% of a company's value was explained by its fixed assets. Now that's only 15%, and 85% is explained by intangibles. And intangibles is culture, is trust. It is what you do in your value chain. So the fact now that the multi-stakeholder, longer-term run companies that put sustainability at the core are getting consistently better financial results, bar a few exceptions always, but getting better financial results, I think is broadly moving the financial market. And the convergence of this dilemma of profit or purpose is increasingly being solved, unfortunately, by the fact that we've waited so long to deal with these issues, but it's increasingly being solved. There is a focal minority in politics, as we've seen, especially in the US, but also in business, in the financial market, that makes you believe otherwise. And as you normally can expect with the press, etc., they like to give them a disproportionate share of voice. But if you look at the proxy season this year in the US, where you can measure the numbers a little bit better, most of the questions were about ESG. Not about pure performance as we've seen before. Many of the CEOs that are being asked to leave is because they fall short on delivering in the areas of ESG, not necessarily on the profit side. You look at the ESG funds that have significantly step changed, the performance of these funds versus others in general. And whilst there is a short-term blip that might push you back to fossil fuel, and some people jump on that right away and I told you so type comments, the underlying trend is very clear. Every 6 seconds in the world, there's a piece of environmental legislation. You have the IRA, you have now the European Green Deal, but now the sustainability packets. We're finally getting a race to the top, it seems. I read an article in the Financial Times last week that said, which is not the most progressive paper in telling you what is going to happen in the world, if I may say, but they reckon that it is 7 to 10 times acceleration of the efforts versus what we've seen in the preceding years. And I tend to believe that that's more or less the case. So these things might converge. What you have to do, and this is very important, and I want to be very clear here, and we spent a lot of time in the book as well, nobody is telling you that if you pay more attention to the environmental and social challenges which are affecting your business model. Business cannot succeed in these failing societies, as we've often talked. So as you work those, you need to work them in a way that makes your company stronger. You need to be still incredibly disciplined on demanding performance, on hiring the right people, on investing in R&D, on making the right M&A decisions, on taking costs out of the system that consumers are not willing to pay for or can't afford to pay for. So this whole notion of a purpose will carry you is also very naive. You need to have leaders nowadays, and coming to the leadership, that are a different type of leaders, that are undoubtedly leaders that need to have a higher sense of humanity, humility, empathy, compassion, stronger purpose-driven, embracing partnership, thinking multi-generational. These leaders tend to succeed more than the old, you know, ego leaders that we've had before, if I may, and that are still around. So there's no doubt that you have that change in leadership characteristics, being more successful, just as we have seen the bifurcation in business models. We see that bifurcation in business. But having said that, you still need leaders that understand that that goes hand in hand with delivering on performance. In Unilever, we had 10 years of top and bottom line growth. We outperformed our competitors year after year. We had a 300% shareholder return, well above the market, well above our industry. So I had people that come into my office with wonderful ideas, but if they couldn't explain to me how it made Unilever stronger, I had a hard time accepting these ideas, not because I was Cruella, the terrible, but because I thought that the way to gain that competitive advantage is to be a little bit smarter than our competitors and being able to deal with some of these trade-offs and hiring people that were able to do that. And I think we've broadly shown that. Our journey certainly wasn't finished in the 10 years I was there, but we've shown that you can step change these organizations in that direction and that it doesn't have to go at the expense of the longer-term shareholders.
So you could write a PhD thesis in response to the next question I'm going to ask you, and I'm not going to require that of you. But as a CEO of Unilever, your business had a very significant segment in food. And one of the great sources of hope for many people is that we will move away rather rapidly from industrially farmed animal-based proteins, and we'll begin to embrace both new forms of food, plant-based alternatives, but also all the incredible innovations that molecular biology and all of this research is doing. So give us your sense of who you think are going to be winners or losers, or things that you think are exciting in this space that, again, in the net positive framework, give you hope.
So I might disappoint you a little bit in your answer, but also encouraged, giving you an encouraging part on your answer. The disappointing part might be on technology. I think we're getting carried away here a little bit by talking to ourselves, to a few people in Singapore or anywhere else where you have cellular meat. And yes, there is technology. If you can feed the cow better and the methane goes down, then we're all happy. So that will happen. But I think we're getting carried away a little bit on technology. You know, we just need to go back in the way we did agriculture. And many indigenous people are still practicing it. And there is increasing evidence that we can go back to regenerative agriculture, and which doesn't require a great deal of things. I'll talk that in a second, and attack most of the problems that we have in the value chain on the bigger scale. Then there will always be innovators on the side. Sure, we need precision agriculture. Sure, we need the green fertilizer and green ammonia to make it. Would be great if we can get further advances in cellular meat, but that's not where the answer is. These are on the fringes that get excitement and the newspaper, but it's not where the solution is. So agriculture is about 30% of the climate change issue. The main key drivers of that are deforestation, which is actually two-thirds driven by the need for feedstock for animals, and soy being one of the bigger ones. And then the other big factor is methane. And then the third big factor is unsustainable agricultural practices, especially tilling of soil, etc. So the interesting thing is it's also 30% of the solution. So we cannot get in any country to the Paris agreements now if we don't include our nature-based systems, our food systems, our food and land use systems into that equation. And that was a big oversight of Paris, where very few people made serious commitments. That is a big oversight of the COP negotiations, where there is an energy transition there included, but limited attention on food. Now that changed a little bit with Alok Sharma and others at the COP26 in Glasgow, where we had the food days. In Egypt, we were able to get it on the agenda. But even in the final text, let's not kid ourselves, nature-based solutions was taken out again. So we have a lot of education to do at the governmental level. There are very few countries that have a deep decarbonization plan of our food systems. So this is one of the areas that we're now focused on with incredible attention. It happens to be that every dollar invested in food to make it more sustainable will give you now about a $15 return. It's probably one of the most profitable investments you can make. It happens to be that if we make changes in our food systems, then in the next 3 to 4 years, if we stop eating meat, we'll see it right away. But in the next 3 to 4 years, you can see fundamental changes. In the energy transition, it often takes longer because you have such a big sunk capital investment there. So this is a very attractive area. The COP15 in Montreal last year, the biodiversity COP, it is as called, which is now a broadly accepted agreement to halt nature loss and restore nature loss as of 2030, is incredibly encouraging because that's probably condition number one. And the best technology, if you want to, where we should get very excited about is called a tree. And someone invented that for us, and it's doing incredibly well if we let it grow. But as long as we value a dead tree more than a tree that's alive, we're obviously in trouble. So we need to change that valuation system there. But the COP15 is giving hope. And then regenerative agriculture is coming to the foreground now, where we have seen, like in fossil fuel, that most of the subsidies of governments, the European Common Agricultural Policy, some of the policies in the US, etc., are pushing us in the wrong direction. We reckon about $600-700 billion of PERFA subsidies go there. So if we can repurpose those subsidies and move them in the right direction, if we can help the farmers shorter term overcome the undoubtedly little yield drops by moving from non-sustainable agriculture to sustainable agriculture, then we can see quite a fast acceleration. So that's what we're focused on right now. Think about farmers being paid for landscape protection, biodiversity restoration, carbon capture. All these things are now possible. We're not far from that. Then with a little bit of help on subsidies for yield drop, cost for cover crop to restore soil health, some of the machinery that needs to be acquired to plant the crops differently, then we can have a fairly quick transition for all of the farmers. And that's what we're currently focused on. I think with a global investment of 50 billion a year for the next few years, we can come quite far in getting to 50% regenerative agriculture by 2030. And that probably people look back at as one of the biggest contributions to fighting climate change. Now, the added benefits are not only the smallholder farmers, because many living in poverty being better off, but also more nutritious food. So you get into health, you get into equity, you get into just transitions. So that's what I like, because the food system is really the heart of the sustainable development goals. If we fix the food system, you directly or indirectly fix quite a lot of sustainable development goals. So I'm passionate about that in a sense that I decided to buy my own farm, which we have now in the south of England, and we're trying to move to regenerative agriculture. So I've understood the complexities of it now 10 times better, but I've also been more convinced that we can actually, keeping the farmers in the center, keeping the indigenous people in the center, who are often the stewards of the land, that we can find solutions probably quicker than what we've had before. So the UAE now is giving it a lot of attention in the upcoming COP, and hopefully we can lift this at the speed that the world requires.
I'm always struck when listening to you that the numbers that you articulate that are required to finance this transition don't feel daunting. They feel perfectly deliverable, whether it's the agricultural transition numbers you've just articulated or the costs of establishing marine reserves for fish to allow them to regrow and then carbon sequestrate and feed coastal communities. All of these are very doable numbers. And what is really absent is leadership. And what I therefore want to do as a final question is ask you something which is almost a little more practical, but also a bit more philosophical. You have been a CEO. You've had to establish a C-suite. When you're sitting down and thinking about the people who you're going to hire on your inner sanctum to be on your team to help drive complex, difficult changes, what are the qualities that you look for most?
Well, I mentioned some of the characteristics of a successful leader before, so I won't want to repeat that. But I think the first thing is a little bit what Rumi, a 13th century poet in Iran, said it very well when he said, "Yesterday I was smart, I tried to change the world. Today I'm wise, I'm changing myself." So people with an ability to learn, unlearn, with a certain level of curiosity, it's tremendously needed. I've always had a big fear of being obsolete with my kids, with my grandchildren, with my friends around me, because we all have an urge to belong to be part of. But if we don't add value, it's difficult to justify. So you need people that have that level of curiosity, if you want to. The second thing I would look to is people that are thinking, that understand the importance of goes well beyond themselves. That first and foremost, we're here for a broader reason, that humanity is connected, that we cannot succeed unless we all succeed. And that's a very important thing. Leadership for me ultimately is about putting yourself to the service of others and knowing that by doing so, you're better off yourself as well. That's a deeper concept that needs more time to explore, but that would be the second thing. And the third one might be perhaps surprising, but I would look at people that think a little bit broader about stakeholders, not only including the planet, but, you know, we always miss the most important stakeholder in all the discussions, which is the future generation. And I understand that they can't sit at the table because most of them aren't born yet, but who's going to represent them? So people that understand that. And so if you have those characteristics, I think, and often that shows itself in a strong sense of purpose, in a way that these people live their lives, how they want to make a difference, that are easily flushed out by the discussions that you have. In Unilever, when we moved to the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, We had no problem attracting people. They want to work for a company with purpose. We became the third most looked up company on LinkedIn. We got about 2 million people applying every year. But then the problem was we couldn't interview them all. And we were hiring about 7,000-8,000 a year, but this was obviously more than we could deal with. But no problem attracting talent. But we changed our recruiting ways quite significantly to look at what we called the inner core and the outer core. And what I've discovered more myself, perhaps later in life than I would have liked, but that the inner core is a more important element than the outer core. The outer core is easily dealt with and taught and brought up to date, but the inner core is very special. So we look for those type of people, and I think these people would be more successful in whatever they do and tend to work better in environments that are more complex that need the efforts of others as well. And, you know, it's Wangari Maathai, also from your part of the world, from Kenya. She said it very well that when she said that if you seek enlightenment just to advance yourself or your own causes, you miss purpose. But if you seek enlightenment to help others achieve their causes, you live a life with purpose. So these are the type of people that I certainly would be looking for.
Paul Polman, that has been a wonderful masterclass. Thank you enormously for your time. Again, your most recent book, Net Positive, How Courageous Companies Thrive by Giving More Than They Take. I commend to everybody who is listening. And I want to thank you for your leadership, for your contribution to the planet, and your contribution to the Conduit community, because you've been here from the beginning and we've been honored to have you amongst our members.
No, thank you, Paul. The respect is mutual. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Paul and his work, please visit his website. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.